Welcome to ProPublica Live in conversation with Jason Leopold. I'm thrilled to be here for what I know will be a fascinating and instructive discussion. My name is Cynthia Gordy. I'm the Director of Marketing for ProPublica. And for those unfamiliar with ProPublica, we are an independent nonprofit newsroom that produces investigative journalism in the public interest. Our work focuses exclusively on important stories that expose abuses of power and betrayals of public trust by government, business, and other institutions. And we use the moral force of journalism to spur positive change. So I hope you'll check us out at ProPublica.org. You can also sign up for our newsletter at ProPublica.org/newsletter. So in addition to the folks in the room, we also have an online audience. So to those online, thank you for joining us. You can participate in the conversation and ask questions by using the hashtag ProPubLive. And of course, everyone in the room also use that hashtag. On Twitter, Jason Leopold is at Jason Leopold, and our moderator, Eric Umansky, is at Eric Uman. So before we get started, I want to thank our event sponsor, and that is the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation. The Dodge Foundation funds art, education, environmental, and media initiatives in New Jersey to promote meaningful change on important issues right here in New Jersey. And finally, I want to thank my fellow host organizations for tonight, NJ Spark and Rutgers University School of Communication and Information. Thank you for all of the work that made this come together. And with that, next we'll hear from the chair of Rutgers School of Communication and Information, Jack Bradich.
Thanks, Cynthia. I'm the chair of the Journalism and Media Studies Department, and on behalf of that department, I welcome all of you here, and it's great to see a turnout like this, especially in a December evening. You know, for a lot of students, this is crunch time, and so it's really great to see a number of students as well as other folks out here tonight to hear this important discussion. So I want to thank also the Dodge Foundation. I want to thank ProPublica and also Simon Galperin for all of his work in putting this together. So I'll just say briefly that I've been chair since 2012, and what I've seen is an amazing explosion of interest and organizational work around investigative reporting in ways that before becoming chair it was still there, but you know, even our courses weren't really that vibrant, our investigative reporting courses. Since then, I'll just list a few things, national and very local. One, obviously we know that based on things like the Snowden revelations and Glenn Greenwald's Poitras's work with that, plus Jeremy Scahill's ongoing work in investigating anti-war through documentaries, the emergence of things like The Intercept happened, from things like Vice, right, becoming an organization dedicated to investigation and current affairs, to things that are, and I remember also being in Zuccotti Park around Occupy Wall Street and watching Tim Pool cruise around, right, with the live stream, and then eventually him becoming part of Vice as well. Locally, since 2012, we've had two student groups that are dedicated to investigative reporting, Muckers and Ruckmakers. We've seen a JMS alum, Charlie Cradaville, who's here in the back, start New Brunswick Today, right? Both an online presence and a print version that is bilingual, right? And also dedicated very much to the concerns of the community in New Brunswick. And then we've also had, under the very capable leadership of my colleague, Dr. Todd Wolfson, who's here, the emergence of NJ Spark, a social justice journalism and media lab here as well. So these issues range from very global issues around surveillance, war, poverty, labor, migration, to very local ones. And I want to mention one fairly local project that's happening right now, which is the Dirty Little Secrets Project around small toxic sites in New Jersey. This is a project that we're working with NJ Spark and Center for Cooperative Media, yes, and many others, right, to work on these sites. In fact, our spring 2016 investigative reporting class is looking to be dedicated to this project. But I'm running out of my time both in this introduction and as chair, and so I'm really looking forward to an increase in interest and projects around investigative reporting. So with that, I will turn it now over to Simon Galperin, who will introduce our speakers.
That's enough of that. I don't need an inflated head. Hi, everyone. Pleasure to see you all here. thanks to Jack for helping us set up this event. I've been pestering him for months probably about trying to do something and like, what can I do? And this kind of fell into my lap thanks to Cynthia, who reached out to us. So without the help of Jack, I know this event couldn't happen, and certainly Andrew Spark couldn't exist. And for those who don't know, Andrew Spark is a social justice journalism lab at Rutgers University. We're trying to innovate and give students real-world experiences by bringing them together with media makers and journalists to make media for and about underserved communities. And we have some of them here, so if you don't mind giving them a hand for enduring a very experimental semester and working hard and supporting us through our endeavors to make positive change. Again, I want to thank Cynthia for reaching out to me. ProPublica is an incredible organization and an example of the kind of work that we encourage our students to do and we hope to do ourselves. And coincidentally, the students have been working on Freedom of Information Act requests this semester. So the event and the topic is perfect and in line with our course material. For those who don't know already, Jason Leopold, the gentleman to my left, closest to me, has been allegedly referred to as a Freedom of Information Act terrorist for his use of FOIA in his work. Jason is an Emmy-nominated investigative reporter for Vice News. He covers national security, terrorism, civil liberties, and other issues. His aggressive use of FOIA includes some notable events like successful suits against the FBI and Department of Defense. He's also testified before Congress about problems journalists have faced using the Freedom of Information Act, and we're very glad to have him here. So give him a hand, please. And then, of course, there's Eric Umansky, who is an assistant managing editor of ProPublica and a member of its Pulitzer Prize-winning team. Previously, he wrote a column for Slate and was editor of MotherJones.com and has been published in a few other casually notable organizations like the New York Times Magazine and the Washington Post. We're glad to have Eric here to facilitate the dialogue with Jason, so we can give him a hand as well. So I'm happy to say, let's get started. Turning over to you.
Great. So I actually wanted to begin by suggesting that we do this in a little bit of a non-traditional manner, which is that if folks have questions throughout, raise your hand and we can answer the questions. You don't even actually need to raise your hand. You could shout it out if appropriate. Great, so I thought about that we could start from the very basics. But first, I should pause for a moment and just say that this is the first day that Jason and I have met after having an online relationship, if you will.
Not one that was pleasurable for some
right.
time.
Right. He and I got into it a few years ago. We can discuss that later on.
Yeah.
Yes, an online relationship that's lasted 10 plus years.
Yeah.
And this is the first day.
And this
in
is the first
person.
Time we're meeting. It's
right.
A...
Right, we're meeting cute, right?
Very sweet.
So I thought we would actually begin with the very basic notion of what the hell FOIA is.
So FOIA is the Freedom of Information Act. It's a law. It's almost half a century old. Next year, it will be half a century old. In fact, one of the proponents of getting FOIA passed was, believe it or not, Donald Rumsfeld, the former Secretary of Defense. If you can believe it, but he was. And the Freedom of Information Act is essentially a law that allows you to ask the government for information, petition the government for documents.
And before that, I mean, how did it work? Just to give a sense of some context, right?
Yeah, there was that it just was non-existent.
So you had no right to actually just...
No.
Not that I rather...
I mean, people would sort of, you know, there were certain requests that were made, but this was a law that Congress passed. It's notable, by the way, that when Congress passed this law, they exempt themselves from FOIA. So you cannot FOIA Congress, but it only applies, at least on the federal level, to the executive branch agencies. There are ways to try to find, you know, communications from members of Congress. Then you have, obviously, the various state level sunshine laws and open records requests, but essentially allows anyone, at least on FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act on the federal level, allows anyone around the world to ask the government for anything, really. And they don't have to give anything to you, but it is that law that exists that allows you to, you know, to make those requests. And in the past few years, I will say, it's really, there's been an upswing, an uptick in terms of how many people have been using this this incredibly powerful tool to try and pry loose information.
So do you want to talk about, I certainly had this for a number of years, that FOIA seems like this almost intimidating thing to do. You know, it's a very technical thing, and it's, right, and you need to know all these code numbers. So it turns out it's not that difficult, and in fact, there are forms online that can help you generate and so forth. You want to just talk through the basics of what it actually means to FOIA something, literally what it entails?
Absolutely, and I do it in many different ways. Sometimes I will get a tip from maybe it's a source or maybe even I'm on the phone with a member of a congressional staffer about a document or a memo or a letter that exists, and it's very difficult these days to get anyone in any government agency and even at the local level to just voluntarily turn something over, even if it's benign, if it's not publicly available. So oftentimes you have to request it. And essentially what it means is, for me at least, I have a template. And in this template,
template being literally a Word file template?
Literally like a Word file template, like where I literally plug in, the information that I'm seeking. And that, can be scary to some people, right? Where it's like, whoa, because my templates are, with the help of my great attorney, Jeffrey Light, is 13, 14 pages long. But some people file requests and it's just a paragraph. I want the memo that says you can go to war in Syria, or the 60 words, the authorization to use military force or whatever it is. But it always serves, it's always the benefit to the requester to actually, try and instruct the agency where to search. So I simply just ask for, it can be anything. It could be, I'll just give you an example. When the Snowden revelations came out, I was wondering what the NSA's talking points were. What are the talking points that they prepared behind the scenes to deal with these revelations that were about Edward Snowden? And I filed this request and it literally said, dear NSA, please give me your talking points for, the Snowden revelations. And then it said a whole bunch of other things on where to search, what I want, and those are the technical details. And then, but that was the essential information.
Sincerely, Jason Leopold.
Sincerely, right? Jason Leopold, exactly. Yeah. And 3 months later, I got the talking points. And they were remarkable because it basically said, just say 9/11. That's really what it said. But it was that simple. I asked for Keith Alexander, who's a former NSA director, his emails. Remarkably, they gave me his emails, So you can ask for, for anything.
So I want to just remind people, anybody who has a question, just raise your hand and I'm happy to jump in. One of the things is that I'm interested in, you and I have spoken a little bit about, is the changes essentially in government transparency or lack of transparency over the years. So you've now laid out how FOIA is supposed to work, right?
Yes, it's supposed to work, obviously, where the presumption is on for disclosure.
Right. So now let's talk about how it really works.
Yes. And it's the opposite. When President Obama was sworn into office in 2009, he signed many executive orders, aside from promising to close Guantanamo. He also signed an executive order promising to usher in a new era of transparency and open government. Because of how secretive it was during the Bush years. A couple of months after that, in March of 2009, then Attorney General Eric Holder issued some new guidelines for all these, for the Justice Department and instructing all these agencies to, side on, the presumption would be for disclosure. It has not worked that way. This has been a highly secretive administration. They will say publicly they are the most transparent in history and point to all these sort of, odd statistics that would, show, it's sort of like, basically cooking the books, that they are being transparent. But the fact of the matter is, particularly on the national security side, and even civil liberties, they're not transparent at all. It often results in requesters having to go to court, having to litigate, in order to force these agencies to be transparent.
So I think I'm actually just remembering this now. James Risen, a New York Times reporter, famous New York Times national security reporter, who is the reporter who uncovered the warrantless wiretapping during the Bush administration, has referred to, and so this is a guy who has some serious experience with secrecy and, frankly, government dissembling, has referred to the Obama administration as the most secretive in history.
Yeah. I would say that's true. I mean, with the Bush administration, they were trying to get the, some members of Congress were trying to turn this into a real partisan issue when I was testifying before Congress, and trying to get me to say, to more or less say that about Obama and in comparison to Bush. The difference between the Bush administration and the Obama administrations, as I said, during this testimony, is that under Bush, I knew I wasn't getting anything. They made it very clear, we are not going to give you anything, Under, this administration, they promise to be transparent, but do the opposite. And just to remind people that in 2009, when, after Obama was sworn into office and he put this executive order out, the administration, just several months later, they actually had this, there was this court case that required the government to, the administration to turn over photographs related to the treatment of detainees in Iraq and Afghanistan prisons, and turn that over to the ACLU as part of their wide-ranging FOIA lawsuit. There was a lot of backlash because the administration actually said that they were not going to fight this decision. And the backlash was pretty fierce. It was bipartisan. And so the administration made it clear that they were going to appeal this. They changed their mind. They're not going to release these records, these photographs.
Of abuse of detainees.
Yeah. They were going to head up to the appeal to the Supreme Court. And essentially what happened was they wound up working with Congress to change FOIA in a way that would block the release of those photographs and any other images pertaining to
the FOIA law was actually changed?
It was changed. It was changed that would require the Secretary of Defense to sort of sign off on, certifying this every 3 years, saying we can't release this because it will endanger our troops or national security. So the law was actually changed. So this is an administration who said, hey, we're being very transparent, and then literally working with Congress to ensure the change in this law.
So let me ask a naive question about that, right? I mean, so Obama promises to be the most transparent. There's obviously this one issue that they view as essentially a political liability, and they back away from that. But their secrecy isn't limited to these photographs. This is a broad-ranging thing. And why? I mean, why would the Obama administration, of all the administrations, be right up at the tippy top in terms of secrecy?
It's a great question. It's one that's really just, honestly, very difficult to understand because it's across the board. It's not just the CIA or the FBI or areas of national security. This goes for the Department of Treasury. This goes for, the EPA. There seems to be this great fear that, one, the release of this information will be hugely terribly embarrassing. That really is a fear. And so you will get agencies that will ultimately release information, but they'll put certain redactions that essentially allows them to sort of just black out information only because it's just embarrassing. But it's really unclear why they're so secretive. I mean, I found out just from what I call the meta FOIA. The meta FOIA is where you can ask for these things called processing notes, and it allows you to sort of get some insight about what goes on behind the scenes.
You're FOIAing the process of your own FOIA,
right?
Which is
and then that's really going. Deep into that. Like you're going digging down. So I mean, but it's fun, and the agencies hate it, but they eventually give up, some records, and it provides insight as to what's happening. And oftentimes, I found out that it's, there's embarrassment there, or they're scared that, some information that you're seeking will attract negative media attention. The fact of the matter is that this is just, at least on the federal level, the Office of Information Policy, which is part of the Justice Department, they're supposed to make sure that all these agencies are abiding by these guidelines that would, again, as part of then Attorney General Eric Holder's guidelines, to make sure that people are getting information that that they're doing their jobs as you know under the executive order. And they've just failed miserably. So they're not doing a good job. So it hasn't trickled down, you know, into these agencies. And as you can see with, you know, with like Hillary Clinton and the, you know, the State Department, they're now just completely backlogged with these, you know, with these FOIA requests, because now everyone, including me, is sued for Hillary Clinton's, you know.
Jason is being modest. Jason is the one responsible for better or for worse, for the Hillary Clinton emails that folks have been hearing about over the course of the last year. It was a lawsuit that you brought that brought them to light.
Yes. Yeah. And that was before the scandal broke. I have another attorney that I work with. His name is Ryan James, and he's amazing.
You're getting a discount from your attorneys for mentioning their names?
Yeah. By the way, Ryan James, in case, did he hear that? But no, I mean, these attorneys work really hard. And I mean, I filed it. They do all the, you know, legal work. And this was before the scandal even broke. I mean, we had no idea that she was using a private email account. I just simply wanted to gain access, you know, to her records, because she was going to be the Democratic presidential front runner. And as soon as we filed, you know, it was a month or so later, because I knew that we'd have to sue. We sued, and the scandal broke. Then it went into, you know, into court, and then a judge forced, you know, issued an order forcing the State Department to release it to us on a rolling basis. And the public benefits, because it's not just to me, it's to everyone.
And you've talked about, I should say, Jason was at ProPublica's offices this afternoon where we had a very nice lunch and chatted about some of this stuff. So
Eric bought me a great sandwich.
It is true. There's delicious Italian sandwiches.
Amazing.
There. Yeah. But one of the things you talked about is this isn't, you know, something that's just sort of stuck in the bureaucratic bowels or some such, right? That this that these decisions can go quite high. So in fact, you had the experience of when you essentially FOIA'd your own FOIA of finding out that one of your FOIAs had gone all the way up to the Secretary of Defense, who had then commented on it and make a decision, which, you know, to be clear, is not how it should happen, because these shouldn't be political decisions.
Right.
These should be decisions based on,
yes,
you know, the facts. So
it politicizes the process. I mean, there have been many times. In fact, what I found out, and it was through another nonprofit organization that filed a FOIA, and I went off on their heels and filing another FOIA, that the Department of Defense specifically has, I forget how they refer to it, but it's essentially all of the FOIA requests that may generate media attention that have to get pre-department approval before anything is released, or approval somehow. And so I actually filed a list of what those, you know, I wanted a FOIA, find out what exactly those were. None of mine were on there, and I was very disappointed. But there were others on there that were like, what? This is, you know, some of these things were just crazy. So that right there, you could see how it becomes politicized. And the fact that more people are actually using this tool, you know, and not just journalists, by the way, but the public, just members of the public, you know, are using this tool, it puts these agencies into a bind that they really do, you know, fear that this is going to get some, you know, perhaps some negative attention. So it goes up the flagpole. I mean, on the, you know, I can understand on some of the Edward Snowden documents that I've, you know, asked for that it, you know, they're worried about, you know, the what kind of attention it will get. So it does go up to, you know, very high up. But again, it politicizes it, and it's that's not the way it's supposed to work.
Hi, my question was, when you get your information, since you said it was basically it goes through the political ranks, is there a filter that you can release the information of what limitations the press has in order to release the information to the general public, or it's just a free-for-all of information after you get it?
You mean that I could release?
Right, right.
Yeah, no, I mean, I could release it to anyone I want. I mean, I think that's actually an important note. So everything that I write that has to do, in fact, I have a news story out today on vicenews.com about one of the U.S. citizens who was killed in a drone strike, along with Anwar al-Awlaki. I post these documents along with the stories. You know, not every news organization does that. I know ProPublica does that. And it's just really important, you know, because it does become part of that transparency initiative to ensure that you're sharing this with everyone. Just to give you an example, I had a lawsuit along with one of my colleagues about the CIA's alleged hacking into the Senate's computers when the Senate Intelligence Committee was preparing their report on the CIA's torture program. And so there was this big controversy that erupted that the CIA was spying on the Senate, and it really led to a near constitutional crisis. Dianne Feinstein made this extraordinary floor statement, and so I filed this lawsuit, you know, with my colleague, and you know, we asked for all the documents behind the scenes. The CIA turned over documents, and they turned over one document that apparently they shouldn't have, and they asked me not to post.
You got a phone call.
Document.
You got a phone call, a sheepish
phone call. Yes, I got a phone call from the CIA, and it was this is what they said. Yeah, that was a freebie, and I'm like, what do you mean? Like, yeah, we shouldn't have given you that document, and we don't want you to post it. And I said, okay, I hear you. I was trying to figure out at that point, oh man, what should the lead of my story be? And then after I hung up the phone, I'm like, oh, this is perfect. I now know the lead of my story. It wasn't a document that would have, you know, been a grave threat to national security. This is an example of what I'm talking about.
You should say what the document was.
This was an apology letter that CIA Director John Brennan wrote to Dianne Feinstein for spying on the Senate, for hacking into their computers. That's what it was.
They actually have a pre-printed card, right? I'm sorry I spied on you.
Yeah. You know, like, whoops. The funny thing is that I didn't even know that this was the document until I spoke to a Senate staffer who informed me that they never received this apology letter. So the CIA basically said they didn't want me to post it, but there was no reason not to. And even if it were something where, you know, it was a mistake and it could have been a national security issue, you know, they would have had to make a good case. But point being that at that point, it's mine, I can release it to everyone. One more example is actually with the Department of Health and Human Services. I asked for all these documents related to Ebola. You know, when the Ebola crisis outbreak was happening, there were discussions about drugs, you know, what kind of drugs that they could come up with, you know, for dealing with it. And they accidentally disclosed to me information that would have revealed what they say are trade secrets. Basically what that was, you know, the name of the company that was providing them with whatever drug related to Ebola. And so they said, whoops, we didn't redact that. Can you do it? And I'm like, you're talking to the wrong guy, you know. And I think they got the message, like, you know, afterwards. The funny thing, though, is that after I testified before Congress, I started getting these phone calls and emails from various FOIA offices saying, hey, Jason, we saw your testimony for Congress. We just want you to know that we're dealing with your request, and we haven't forgotten about you. And it was like, whoa, this is cool.
Just a quick question. So I kind of lost track of the Feinstein letter. Did you use it or not use it?
Oh, kidding. We put it up. Not only did we use it, we blew it up, and it was big. The letter was 8x10. I think we made it by like 50x something. Yes, we used it. We posted it on the story. It became like sort of a centerpiece. I mean, the funny thing is that, you know, it was sort of underscored the whole point that, you know, Feinstein was trying to make. About what was happening at this time, and, you know, sure enough, this letter sort of proved it. I mean, it's a very lengthy story that's out there, but yes, no, that was, like I said, it really was sort of part of the lead of my story that I was spending weeks on, and yes, it would be very hard to miss.
Recently, I filed a FOIA request to the FTC, and I received a letter back stating that they could neither confirm nor deny.
Oh, you got Glomar'd.
And I would.
Nice.
There you go.
Congratulations.
So thank you so much.
It's a badge of honor.
I appreciate that. Yes. Is it a badge of honor?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I would like to know, is this a typical response?
It's interesting.
And how does one address it? And the second set of questions I have to do with, is there fee shifting with attorneys who do FOIA work? In New Jersey, we have fee shifting.
I'm not familiar with
that. You mean like scales for depending on?
No. Under the New Jersey Open Public Records Act, if you file a complaint and you prevail, the prevailing attorney actually gets fees.
Oh, yeah.
Is that true? Is that also the case under FOIA?
Yes, it is.
It is.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, normally for that, it's the FOIA sort of forced the government to release it. They weren't going to release it anyway. With the Glomar, that's what they call it. Glomar, it's after G-L-O-M-A-R, it's after the Glomar destroyer.
Okay. Great.
Really great. There's a
really great story.
Yeah, and there's actually a great Radiolab.
Yes.
Radiolab piece on that. I mean, I highly recommend it. Yeah.
So I'll just tell the story in brief because it's one of the great stories. A Soviet submarine sunk. And it was an advanced submarine, and the U.S. decided we're going to go get the submarine. And so they launched this crazy thing where I think they tried to pull it up with a pulley or something.
Yeah.
And the ship was called the Glomar, right?
Right, yeah.
And someone tried to get information about it, and I think they had this thing of they were in a sticky wicket. They said, wait, well, we couldn't deny it, but to acknowledge it would be a really bad idea too. So we're just going to come up with this elegant thing where we say we can neither confirm nor deny, and that got called the Glomar response.
Yeah, and it was the LA Times that actually first worked on that story.
Great Radiolab. If you type in Radiolab and Glomar, it's a hell of a story because it's a crazy way they brought up a sub from the bottom of the ocean, among other things.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, a Glomar is, you know, Eric was saying badge of honor. Yeah, I think it is. I mean, certainly, you know, I remember when I got my first Glomar, it was like, whoa, I got a Glomar. This is awesome.
They don't, by the way, say it under, like, Glomar.
Yeah.
I just want the
document. But what's really interesting about that is, though, is that with the Snowden, you know, because after the Snowden leaks, just here's, by the way, the NSA is so backlogged. And the reason why is because after the Snowden leaks, they were inundated with requests from people who said, I would like to know if you're spying on me. And no joke, because I actually asked for all these records and it has it there. And it's literally, they got thousands and thousands of requests. I want to know if you're spying on me. Give me all those records, you know. And the NSA generally has this sort of, you know, mandatory response, which is we neither confirm nor deny. And so in these documents that I got, I saw that, you know, they were discussing it and they said, we're just going to have to Glomar. So it's really cool to sort of see them actually use the term. But really, I mean, it's hard to beat a Glomar. It's hard to beat it unless you know that what you're requesting has been discussed publicly. If you can find any information publicly citing whatever it is you're seeking, that you can then appeal and say, this shouldn't, you know, I appeal the decision to, you know, to Glomar. This information has been discussed. Here's an article about it. Here's some official talking about it in Congress. Try to find as much information you can about it. Even then it may, you know, you still may run up against problems with dealing with the agency, but that's really your best bet, is actually, you know, trying to find out as much as you can. So again, just to stay on the leaks from Edward Snowden. So all of this information is out there, right? There's been a lot of information that's been published about these programs that he has, you know, that these documents have revealed, the names of these programs in various publications. And I filed many, many FOIA requests with the NSA just to test the waters to see whether they would give up their documents about it. You know, even though there's public information out there, it wasn't officially released. So they're still Glomar-ing it, right? They're still saying they can neither confirm nor deny. But if you can find anything that would be officially released, discussed, that would be to your benefit.
Just to follow on with that, because I remember a story that actually Scott and I did together a few years ago, the absurdity of this, that we did a story about the drones. We did a series of stories about the drones program. And what we found was administration officials were talking on background, were essentially bragging all the time about all the terrorists that were being killed by drones. You know, And so there were hundreds and hundreds of articles where they're saying unnamed sources, but administration officials talking about so-and-so being killed and so-and-so other person being killed. And then the ACLU had a suit that said, we want the information about the legal justification for drones. And they said, oh, no, we can't do that because we can't acknowledge that there's a drone program.
Right.
Right. So what we did was we ran an article about, that literally showed hundreds upon hundreds of White House officials talking about drones, and then the legal filing that says we can't acknowledge the existence of this program.
And that actually goes to, you know, what the question you were asking earlier about transparency, this administration, secrecy. I mean, it's just highly secretive. That's, you know, particularly when it comes to areas of national security like that. But that's your best bet, man.
You started off talking in regards to one of the FOIAs that you did and how 3 months later, and that it was the ideal situation. And then you just mentioned the word backlog in regards to this. So we're talking about something that you really should feel passionate about because this is going to be settle in for a long winter's nap type of situation, right? What is the longest that you have waited on action being taken?
I'm still waiting. In fact, I could probably read you an email I got today from the Department of Energy that says, hey, this was 3 years ago I filed this. Hey, Jason, we just got to, you know, you're processing it. Your request, this was for an Inspector General report. Are you still interested in getting it? Yeah. And I'm like, yes, I'm still interested in getting this. Send it to me, for crying out loud. I was thinking other words, but that's the word I typed. I mean, there are requests that are, you know, 5 years that are still, you know, outstanding. I was very surprised with the Department of Homeland Security recently, and I wrote this story recently. The Department of Homeland Security is huge, and they have a huge backlog. In fact, I think that they're the agency that received the most FOIA requests out of all government agencies last year. But I filed a FOIA request with them about the protests in Baltimore related to the death of Freddie Gray. And I filed it. I said, I want to, you know, with a couple of divisions within the Department of Homeland Security. Remarkably, they sent me a bunch of documents, 700 pages, within 3 weeks. That was the fastest I ever received a response, the fastest. And there was an amazing story in there because it showed that they were monitoring various Twitter accounts of leaders in the Black Lives Matter movement, and monitoring them for, you know, sort of information. That was sort of seen as, you know, not a very good thing. They have rules on that. So that was the quickest. The longest, I'm still waiting, you know, NSA, there's, you know, it's been 3 years. I mean, I have friends that have been waiting 10 years. But that's crazy. I mean, if you're waiting 10 years, that's truly, it's worth investing the money to sue. I mean, it depends on how badly you want it. I want everything, and I want it like tomorrow, you know? So you know, I would love to just constantly sue everyone. Even Eric. I threatened to sue Eric.
We'll get into that, yeah.
I know when requests get denied, sometimes it's not just specifically for like a subject matter kind of exemption, but sometimes they say that it's unduly burdensome or that they simply just can't find the record.
Yeah.
In the course of your lawsuits, how often have you gotten to, or your lawyers gotten to depose the clerks or custodians to ask about their process?
Never. No, that's never happened. I mean, that would be awesome. They have, I mean, what's really great about some of these lawsuits, those that are in charge of the head of the FOIA office at these various agencies, they will submit declarations, you know, talking about the search, talking about the documents. And oftentimes these declarations will be very valuable and newsworthy, particularly CIA, NSA, you know, recently the NSA FOIA chief submitted a declaration revealing that there were 3 other emails that Edward Snowden sent, you know, that may have kind of met that sort of, not necessarily met the definition of concerns, but that he sent to the office that he sent them to. So that was valuable. It was valuable information. But you never get the chance to, you know, to depose anyone to, you know, sort of get any information out of them. But the unduly burdensome part is used a lot. And I know the State Department loves saying that. And there's actually a response that you can give when, you know, when they say that, especially, I mean, the requirement is for you to basically describe the records you're seeking. Sometimes they'll say, well, it's unduly burdensome because we have 20,000 pages. Great, give me all 20,000 pages, you know.
Getting back to some of the nuts bolts, thank you both for being here. Not everyone in this room has a lawyer or a 14-page template that they're working from. What are strategies for people to use to actually get their FOIA responded to and potentially successfully,
sure,
given the glut? And then also, if you guys can talk about your fight, we'd appreciate that too.
Which one do you want first?
Dealer's choice.
Okay, so.
You talk about FOIA strategy, okay. So I'll talk about the FOIA.
You know, the way I learned about FOIAs early on, besides being around, you know, hanging around the FOIA crowd, was actually you can ask for the, you know, these various government agencies for the administrative case files, you know, on certain FOIAs. And that basically would provide you with my templates, you know, or anyone else's. I mean, there's a lot of the letters and requests online, and it really is beneficial. I mean, you could find that if you typed in the ACLU and, you know, and other people. I mean, you could find it that way. Yeah.
I was just going to say, I mean, years ago, I remember, and I don't know, probably something better exists now, there was something called the FOIA generator.
Yeah, and Muckrock, I mean, you know, is out there.
What's that? I'm sorry?
Muckrock.
Yeah, Muckrock.
You know, you can use that. It's sort of helpful, very helpful in terms of creating that sort of template, if you will. And the FOIA generator, I think, is Reporters Committee.
Yeah,
I think so. That's still there as well. So there's a lot of those useful sort of go-betweens, if you will, that will help sort of put that together. But really, I think that, you know, sometimes reading other people's requests is truly important. So just reading the language, what they're asking for, it's, you know, when you say like, how can you get it? How can you file a good request and get documents quickly? It's also really important that you read the law, you know, understand the FOIA, right? We're journalists, and so that's part of it in terms of, and even the public, you know, who, you know, maybe citizen journalists, you know, we're all journalists, but it's important to really know what the law says. You know, and each government agency, at least on the federal level, has at the bottom of their page or somewhere there a link to the FOIA, right? Read it, you know, read what the regulations are. So really absorbing that information only will benefit you when it comes to filing that. When you are filing a request, make sure you use the right language. You know, sometimes, you know, to getting to his question about unduly burdensome, I want every document that mentions UFOs. Well, there's probably millions of pages. Yes, that would be, you know, burdensome. Try to narrow that down to UFOs in New Mexico on Thursday, whatever day, you know. So, and reading other people's, you know, requests. All agencies, for the most part, at least again on the federal level, and the state level is very different, by the way, because each state has their own law on how you deal with that. But on the federal level, you know, there's FOIA logs. You know, you can go through the FOIA logs where they literally log all of the FOIA requests that come in. You know, and yes, sounds boring, but this is my, you know, these days, this is my fun. It's like, oh man, new FOIA logs out. Oh, going through it. So, you know, just really kind of absorbing all that info is very important. And just, you know, identifying exactly what you want. That actually helps the, you know, the FOIA analyst. So that's just like the best place. On the state level, is just so different. And I do file requests on the state level. But where it differs is that the states are also very secretive, but they will try to deter you from getting any documents by slapping you with insane fees, crazy fees. So this response time is much quicker. But they'll say, oh, you want these documents? Give us $5,000. you know.
We recently had an experience like that and fought it, and it turned into either $21 or $14 from multiple thousands of dollars. So,
yeah, and you know, that's the thing. I mean, with Ferguson, I filed some requests for documents in Ferguson, and they were like testing, like, oh yeah, this will cost you $2,500 or $2,000. And we wanted it quickly, you know, and there was, you know, the fight part of it, weren't willing to, you know, really get into the fight, but we said, okay, we'll pay it. They gave me 8 emails. You know, I think, what does that come out to? You know, $400 an email? I don't know. My math is off, but it was a lot of money. So, yeah. So, I mean, it's really, really, I mean, the best advice I could give you is just read up as much as you can about the law, especially the laws in all various states, and know that, you know, what you can ask for.
So as a journalism student here at Rutgers, I know that every class that I've taken, they emphasize timeliness. And of course, as a journalist, that's like a big key part of being a journalist. How do you use FOIA? You make it sound like it takes so long. So how do you make your articles current? And how do you, I just don't understand the strategy of like filing for something that you want to know now to make.
I backdate all my articles. It's a very lengthy, tedious process. And, you know, I'm filing many FOIAs per week, and largely because, you know, there's many different reasons, but because on the national security side, it's difficult to get information. And I enjoy doing this. I enjoy trying to, you know, force this, you know, the release of these records. And so by doing it as often as I do, it ultimately will hopefully create a pipeline where then months down the road, I'll start getting a regular flow of records. If you are dealing with a story that's breaking, yes, don't expect any Open Records Act to provide you with that information. It is an investment in time. You know, for me, I try to, you know, with these documents that I've received on the U.S. citizen killed in the drone strike, I try to make these, you know, these stories to bring it out, to show why it's still important, even though time has passed. There are many times, however, you know, many instances where it's like, ugh, this is old. I can't do anything with it now. I was just talking about that today about BP, you know, related to the disaster in the Gulf, where I got some documents. You know, I think that kind of the burden is almost on the journalist to show, like, why it should still matter now. I feel truly passionate about that. I mean, I try to make use of everything that, you know, that I get, even if it's too old, because ultimately I believe that the documents, you know, the records belong to the people, to the public. So maybe I'll throw it up on Document Cloud, or, you know, just to share it. But I try to make a story out of it.
Document Cloud is a resource for journalists where primary sources are posted, and obviously you use it. I was involved in the
development. You founded it. You're the founder.
Yes, I disclosed the conflict of interest as well as Scott Klein. But the useful thing for folks to know is that, you know, in terms of understanding FOIAs, the kinds of documents you can get, I mean, I would imagine some plurality, if not majority, of those documents are from FOIAs that are on there. So it's just a useful place to look for the kinds of things you can get. I'm sure there are FOIAs there themselves. The other thing I would say in response to your question about timeliness, I mean, ProPublica is sort of the anti-timely publication. The reason why is that there are certain stories you can tell immediately, and then there are kinds of stories where you're creating the story.
Right.
And that's what we specialize in. I think in large degree, that's what you specialize in. Those are things. There are obviously some things that are going to come out that just aren't relevant. But lots of things people just care about. You know, if you're writing about the drone strike, the justification for killing a U.S. citizen for your drone strike, well, you know what? That was a few years ago. But killing a U.S. citizen with a missile is a hell of a thing. And, you know, people care about that.
Yeah, I think they still care about it later on. I mean, really, it's just, yes. And I think that the time factor, I really do try to plan ahead. You know, I'm not going to give away, like, what's going to expire next year, but I filed something, you know, that I know is going to, you know, expire next year. that will hopefully by, you know, filing it now will get me the documents then. So it's trying to look ahead. That was the whole reason I filed those, you know, the request for Hillary Clinton's emails, because I knew she'd be the, you know, front runner, and I want to see what, you know, what these records would show. It, there was no, by the way, nothing partisan about it. It was simply like, you know, these are important documents.
So what do you do when you get 20,000 pages of, I mean, I don't even know if
I throw a party. I mean, when I get 20,000 pages.
How do you make sense of all that information, especially when, let's say something's created digitally and you file your request and maybe they turn it into a dead tree, they give it to you, you turn it back into something digital. How do you, and it's very difficult to search, you know, PDF. I mean, so part of the impediments that get put in your path, right, are that you have to process all this information.
Yes.
So can you talk a little bit about that? Any tools that you use or tools you wish existed that would help you do that?
Yes, more people. That's one thing I wish existed more. I mean, it is difficult. I mean, I was, I'm working on something now related to Guantanamo that I've discussed with, you know, with Eric and Scott. It's just labor intensive to sort of digest these documents that are very, very valuable, and to sort of, you know, figure out what the story will ultimately be. You know, there are times when I receive, you know, a couple of thousand pages of documents. You know, I try to sit with it for a while. I mean, it's I'll read it once, I'll read it again. I essentially, you know, make notes about page 22. This is what I did with the latest story on Samir Khan, the U.S. citizen killed in a drone strike. Weren't that many pages, but, you know, I read the documents and I went through it again. Page 22, he bought an Acer notebook, you know. And from there, I see, you know, what my sort of notes look like, and then I get an idea of what the narrative will look like based on that. But, you know, when you're getting that huge, that large volume, it's, if that's what you're referring to, a big volume of records, I mean, it's just a matter of investing, you know, the time. And this was one of the challenges, I mean, honestly, with these CIA records I received, was there was such an overwhelming number of records related to their spying on the Senate, an overwhelming number of records that just was like, whoa, this is a lot, and became somewhat technical. How do I turn this into plain English? That was actually a big challenge. It actually required me sharing those records with a number of different people who were experts who could explain it to me in plain English, because it was difficult. And not until, like I said, it wasn't until the CIA called and said, hey, you know, don't post that I was like, ah, now I know what my story is going to be. You know, so I do that often. I do share records that I, you know, that I will receive with, you know, with some experts or people who have, you know, the expertise to analyze it and help explain it to me.
I avidly follow you guys, like, on Vice News, on Twitter, your documentaries, all that. And I think either you or one of your colleagues actually visited Seton Hall Law School about the issue of Guantanamo Bay, and you guys spoke to a former detainee. So on the political, looking at it from the political perspective, is there any, can you guys process and use your resources to explore issues internationally between two countries, or is it basically just strictly domestic issues?
Oh no, definitely between two countries. In fact, on that specific story, that was my colleague. I assisted with it, but that was my colleague who did that documentary you're referring to. And on that, I actually have a lawsuit with the State Department where I am, you know, trying to gain insight into what are the discussions that take place between the U.S. and other governments with regard to detainees, specifically when detainees are being released to these other countries. So other countries do have, you know, freedom of information laws. Yemen, they passed a very robust freedom of information law. I was really hoping to, you know, file a request with Yemen, but that's never going to happen now. You know, so yes, you can explore that. In the U.S., anyone around the world can file a request. If the other countries allow, you know, a U.S. citizen or someone in the U.S. to use it, sure, go for it. That's really, like, you know, the global FOIA is what I aspire to one day. So,
Hi. So my question is about how citizens and advocates can use FOIA. Obviously, we understand the role that journalism, FOIA plays in journalism, but how can environmental advocates, advocates for criminal justice reform, or just citizens, you know, average Joe or Jane living on Main Street, how can they use FOIA in your mind to sort of make positive change or find out information that they need?
Sure, but it's really the same way that journalists do. I feel that, you know, on one thing that we benefit from as journalists is that we are entitled to a fee waiver, okay? We are not asking for records for any, you know, for commercial reasons, selling information or what have you. But we are actually providing a public service, you know, and so we demonstrate that to these government agencies when we request these records, that these records are going to be used for a story or a book or a film, and I should be entitled to a waiver of fees because it will benefit everyone. And by the way, that is also why I feel, you know, that it's important to disclose records when you receive them. But I think that citizens, advocates, activists can use it much in the same way. It would be beneficial if you could explain to an agency, so you could get a, you know, some, perhaps a waiver of fees somehow, how you would, what you intend to do with those records. You intend to post those records, write a story about it, maybe work alongside ProPublica, ensure that they're for public consumption. You know, in the Occupy Wall Street days, you could certainly, just as an example, you know, file requests with the FBI and Department of Homeland Security about Occupy Wall Street, and these were, people filed documents to see what roles the federal agencies played, you know, in dismantling the movement. My friend, someone who I've worked on FOIA lawsuits with, his name is Ryan Shapiro. He is also an animal rights activist. He's aggressively used FOIA to, you know, pry loose information about, on a wide range of issues, but on, you know, animal rights issues, shared those documents with, you know, various publications. So really it's, you know, ensuring that what you're asking for will ultimately, you know, benefit the public somehow.
Yeah, I would just add briefly, I mean, Jason and I were talking about this beforehand, and that, you know, lots of advocacy organizations have, in fact, been quite aggressive with FOIA. ACLU has jumped out ahead of news organizations. And the other thing, and I've heard this stat long ago, and I don't know if it's still relevant, but that the majority of FOIAs are not filed by news organizations.
No.
In fact, true. By corporations
That's
and
right.
so forth. So, you know, this is not something that is limited to, you know, you're wearing your fedora and, or, you know, have a reporter badge.
And it's really, this is, by the way, just to sort of segue just for a moment, why I believe, like, FOIA logs are really important, particularly with some agencies, because when a corporation is asking for documents, it's not like they're putting out a press release. They're asking for something. And so, you know, when you see Philip Morris asking for documents, it's like, oh, what are they asking for? And then you can just say, I want everything you gave to Philip Morris.
Which is by a trick you can use with FOIA. If you see somebody in the log, you know, you say, yes. I want everything Cy Hirsch just asked for.
Right, right. Right? You can totally do that. I mean, generally, I think that with journalists, there's an understanding that
right.
you shouldn't do that. But you can. In fact, it's funny because there was a reporter from the Associated Press who asked for a bunch of documents. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. But I haven't. He asked for it like a year ago and nothing ever came out. So I sent him a note. I said, hey, did you write anything on that? Do you mind if I ask for the same thing? He's like, oh, go for it. I'm not going to do anything. So he sent it to me, or I filed the request. They sent me these documents. I'm like, I can't believe I didn't do anything on this. I'm going to write a story. Turned out it was a story about Keith Alexander, former head of the NSA, and his communications with Google, which was amazing. And then he was like, oh man, I missed that in the documents I got. So, so sometimes it's, you know, it is beneficial just to look through it.
Hi, whatever became of that program I read about earlier this summer, where federal agencies said they were going to start posting FOIA responses,
yes.
like publicly before giving them to you, or at the same time.
Right.
And how would you have felt as a journalist about, you know, getting a scoop and filing a request and then them just posting it up for everybody to see?
I was pretty vocal about that. That's a great question. So, various government agencies, this was so crazy, because FOIA really is broken. It's powerful. You know, you can sort of make good use of it. but there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And one of the things that these government agencies decided to do instead of literally fixing the law was to come up with this program called Release to All. So a release to one person, okay, would essentially be released to everyone. And so there were a number of different agencies that were involved with this pilot project. And it was the EPA, Office of Director of National Intelligence, I think some agency, the Department of Homeland Security, some DOD offices, and maybe the Department of Justice. And when it first, basically what it meant is when they release to me, they'll release it to everyone. And, as I just mentioned, I sue for a lot of these documents. So there's an investment of, time, money, and when I get the documents, there's an important sort of moments where you have to, or important time investment to, digest what these documents are about. So I was not happy because that meant that, yes, I'm a journalist, guilty. I would lose out on perhaps a scoop, if everyone else, got these documents too. And that's certainly the case right now with Hillary Clinton. I mean, I'm happy that, everyone's getting those emails, but it really was, my lawsuit that forced everyone else to sort of, be able to get that. So I wasn't happy about this, and I was pretty vocal about it, and people were mad at me because they were like, you're not for the people, and I'm like, come on, give me a week, at least give me a week with the documents. How is that going to hurt you? Anyway, so what happened is that the program's still ongoing, but what it requires, it's not as if these agencies are making a big sort of public statement. We just released a document to Jason Leopold. Everyone, head over here. So they're not doing that. So it requires the agencies do still release it, but it requires a person to literally every day check the page to see if they've released it to everyone. So as an example, the EPA released some records to me several months ago. And they also sent me an email. And this was kind of weird. And it was in all caps. Notification was the subject line. This is a release to all. That's what it said. And I was like, oh my God, they're, this, it's weird. But nobody even was aware that it was released to everyone. So, I would certainly be very worried if I didn't have this opportunity to sort of analyze CIA documents if it were released to everyone. But right now, it essentially the program exists. There have been releases. But in order to know that those releases exist, it requires a regular visitation of the, of these pages that are there. You would have to literally say, I want to see if they posted anything today, in order to, to get that.
Sure. Whoever has the mic back there.
Hi there. I'm Charlie Cradville. I'm a journalist here in New Brunswick. Thank you both for coming and talking. The thing I notice is that increasingly the records that folks are seeking are, new types of digital things. So, for instance, emails. I lucked out and was able to get, several years worth of the city council's emails a couple years ago. But now that same request, they won't give it to me. That's through Oprah, not FOIA. But nevertheless, that's just the city of New Brunswick being the city of New Brunswick. There's also videos, from police incidents, or how do you deal with the concept of not knowing what records exist, or dealing with very voluminous requests that you might need to request, hours and hours of video or days and days of video, and not knowing what's exempted and what's not? And do you end up forcing the government to then have to review all those documents to decide what they're allowed to give you? And how do you cope with, how do you deal with those types of sort of new digital things?
Sure. Well, first of all, the government does review everything before they release it. So on the federal level, and even on the state level, local level, that they are, in fact, the reason why the fees are so high on the local level when they ask me to pay for it is because they're paying their attorneys to basically redact it. So that's where, the money and is going for that and searching. So all the government agencies do, they do conduct a review of the records, determine what can be released, and then turn it over. I always request emails. Emails, whenever I'm requesting records, it's, emails are always in there. But I rarely go on fishing expeditions, And so it sounds a little bit like what you're asking or what you're referring to was a fishing expedition. Like, you don't know what exists. So I don't, I won't say, give me all your videos one day of just something. I have talked about that often, just having conversations like, oh, I wonder if I just, you know, file a request and just say, give me whatever you have. But then they'll come back and say, you know, it's, you know, we have, you know, voluminous material and you have to narrow it down. So I don't often, you know, do that. I try to target, I try to identify what I'm looking for. You know, that's probably really important. For example, in Chicago, you know, what's really interesting, and I was mentioning this earlier about the police shooting of Laquan McDonald, is that the video was ultimately released on that, right? But, and all of these journalists and news organizations filed requests for that video, but only one person sued for it, and he was an independent journalist and has no backing from any news organization, but he decided to go to the next level and seek out a lawyer who I believe took it on pro bono, and they forced the release of that. And I was getting a little away from your question, but it was just amazing that it took an independent journalist to do that. And I think people are really, really fearful of lawsuits. There are some labs that exist that, you know, at Yale, for example, that will actually help file, I believe it's Yale, that will help file a lawsuit. They have to pick and choose. But anyway, to get back to your question, I think I never really try to go on fishing expeditions. It's not, you know, terribly helpful. I do try to identify, you know, or at least target what my request is.
Send Hillary Clinton's emails, right?
Oh, well, okay, yes. So Hillary Clinton, I said, you know, give me every email that Hillary Clinton ever got. Yes, I did ask for that. And they did say, well, you know, eventually you have to, you know, you have to narrow it down. Thank God I asked for like every single one, because it forced them to release all of her emails. But yeah, I think that, you know, videos are things that are not often requested, at least on the federal level. The FBI is a great example. They have a lot of video, you know, that an audio that you could ask for on, you know, a number of different, you know, anything really, you know, that even going back years and years, but on police, you know, law enforcement issues, training videos are fantastic. By the way, seriously, if you want to get amazing video, ask your local police department for all of its training videos. I mean, it's not to be believed. And the music that goes along with the training videos, wow. I mean, the story writes itself right there.
So do folks want to hear about our fight? I feel like we should finally say it. This is actually, in some sense, how you became the FOIA terrorist. So in 2006, folks might have remembered there was a story in which Jason wrote a story saying Karl Rove had been indicted.
Let's make sure everyone knows who Karl Rove is. Right. Does everyone know who Karl Rove is?
Very good editor. Yeah. Right. Karl Rove, the former consigliere to President Bush, saying he had been indicted. What's that?
Bush's brain, right.
Or what did he call him? What was his nickname for him? Like some turd
like
something?
Like turd blossom.
Turd blossom.
Turd blossom,
yeah.
Yes.
Anyway, that he was going to be indicted in connection with the Valerie Plame case. This is all like incredibly dated stuff.
No. Are you talking about my story?
I'm talking about your story.
Yeah, no, I said that not he was going to be indicted.
He had been indicted.
He was
even
indicted.
Even more wrong.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so I, at ericumansky.com, I was then working for Slate, and I, you know, had a blog like everybody had in the early aughts. And I said something like, people shouldn't trust Jason Leopold because he has a dodgy history, or some such.
I think you're being a little kind. I think your words were a little more.
Okay, well, I what I said was.
He wrote it down.
I did. Well, I called him a fabulist, at which point you objected.
Yes.
And I corrected myself and said, I stand corrected. You are a plagiarist.
Yes.
You had some runnings on some stuff. We talked about it earlier. I withdraw my previous accusation of that. But nevertheless, you had some problems.
Yeah.
With
you
had
totally.
Articles that were withdrawn and so forth.
And by the way, I'm when it comes to transparency, I'm really transparent. So there's you know, I've been very transparent about myself. It's all out there.
So, in fact, Jason had, and it's been written about it in stories, you had stories withdrawn. There was these questions about whether things were lifted, although...
Yes.
Right? And in any case, so I wrote this stuff. You wrote me back. And I believe I actually looked at this old blog post, called me, let me see here, lazy, self-righteous, and then you threatened to sue me.
Yeah.
At which point I corrected myself to say, in fact, you're a plagiarist. And we left it there, I think, for a number of years until you started doing actually very good stories.
Well, thank you. This was like, I was pissed. And I remember reading this and I'm like, mother. And just like, you know, this was, to just give you some background on it, this is a good segue because this really sort of will help you understand why I do the type of work I do now. One, I really love journalism, okay? I'm very, very passionate about journalism. I love, you know, the job that I have, and I love having this opportunity. I was working for a news organization where I was publishing stories on the Valerie Plame leak. And it was a nonprofit. It was the name of this news.
That article. Valerie Plame leak, for those who don't know, by the way, was a CIA agent who, in this incredibly circuitous way, had been outed effectively by the Bush administration, by, it turns out, the chief of staff to the vice president, Scooter Libby.
Yeah.
Had been outed as a CIA agent, seemingly in response to her husband raising questions about the Bush administration's claims of weapons of mass destruction. Phew. So that's the details.
Yeah, I mean, it really does feel like dated history, but nevertheless, obviously very important if you look at ISIS now.
Right.
So I had been covering this for a number of years and covering it for a news organization that was not really, you know, one that many people heard of.
Truthout.org.
Truthout.org, yes. And I cultivated sources. You know, my background prior to that was, you know, I worked at the Dow Jones Newswires, LA Times. So I, you know, knew how this game was played of journalism. And I cultivated sources and I felt I did some, you know, some good work on this. And in fact, Valerie Plame, you know, later on, you know, said as much. Not that it really, I was doing this for a number of years. You know, there was obviously lots of competition, and I was fiercely competitive, and also eager to make a name for myself in hopes that, you know, I could sort of go to another level. I remember this because it was a Saturday. I was in the car with my wife. We were driving to a dealership to drop off a car. And I got a phone call from a source. And the source told me that Karl Rove had been indicted. And I said, what? What are you talking about? He said, you know, I've got this information for you. And I pulled the car over and I started, you know, taking down this information. And it was quite detailed. It wasn't just like, hey, this happened. It happened last night. You know, Patrick Fitzgerald, who at the time was a special prosecutor, he had 24 business hours to get his affairs in order, and so he gave me this information, and I followed it up with another source, and you know, this other source said, yeah, that did happen. All I could think about at this moment was literally I had this scoop, you know, mentality where it was only thinking about the scoop, and never once thinking, is there a possibility that this may not be true? Because I trusted my sources, right? And I think that when you develop this source, reporters develop a relationship with their sources, it's built on trust. But they're also, you know, as I learned the hard way, should come with quite a bit of sometimes skepticism. But I believe this to be true. And I actually talked about this to, you know, some of my colleagues in advice. I was also invested in this story in some way. And what I mean by that is that I felt passionate that there was an injustice that took place here, the outing of this CIA operative. This was a terrible injustice that, you know, as a way to sort of, you know, conceal the lies that led, you know, ultimately somehow the Iraq War played into it. But I felt very passionate about that. I did not question my sources. You know, told my editor, we've got a massive scoop on our hands. And really the only thing I could think of is, wow, I wonder how long before the New York Times and the Washington Post pick up the story.
Did you try to call Karl Rove?
I did not try to call Karl Rove, but I did call his attorney. And I also called the spokesperson for the special prosecutor. But it was a Saturday, okay? And of course, that you know, I look back on it now like, what the F was I thinking? Because it was a Saturday. That it's not. I'm sure they're not looking to...
Karl Rove doesn't roll on Shabbos?
No. I mean, I just think that it was like, you know, it was... I didn't feel like it was... At the time, for me, this was urgent. I had to get this out. So I made the phone call. Nobody responded. I had my editor speak to some sources. But this was really, you know, just driven by the fact that this was true and I needed to report it. And I did. And I reported it just like that. And I had been in journalism for quite some time, so it wasn't new to the game. This wasn't, you know, me being naive in a way with my sources, just completely trusting them it was. But I reported it straight out. Karl Rove was indicted here this time, happened then. Here's some color details. I mean, it was filled out. There was not one caveat in the story, not a single caveat in the story. And all I could think of was, like I said, was, you know, how long before other folks picked this up, other media organizations.
Turned out forever.
Right. You had a great sort of response. This was an exclusive.
I said it was it was in the realm of the permanent exclusive.
It was a permanent exclusive.
Which is where you never want to be.
Yes. And obviously, as we all know, Karl Rove was never indicted. But this was a huge, huge, huge fiasco. One that cost me my credibility entirely. I mean, it destroyed my credibility and led to articles and posts like Eric's. It at the time, I mean, I was really upset by it, you know. And I never really imagined that there would be that much blowback and backlash and sort of, you know, hitting me on that. But it was pretty fierce. So it took a toll. You know, it was probably the worst experience I ever had as a journalist. You know, it was an opportunity. And for me, it could have either led to the end of my career or, honestly, I could have figured out, like, what do I do next? And that's what sort of helped lead me to doing what I'm doing now. I mean, this was, you know, to just put a time frame on it, this was 9 years ago. We'll be celebrating the 10th anniversary next June of my, you know, faux pas. But it was a terrible mistake and a very, very hard lesson that, you know, I had to start from scratch. When your credibility is shot, nobody is willing, you know, who's going to trust you? And so I started over. Just by the way, when I was reporting these stories on Valerie Plame, I was using sources who are anonymous, okay? Now, there's a difference when the New York Times and the Washington Post and other outfits that have built some trust with their readers use anonymous sources versus some guy who's working for what? Truth Out, you know, uses anonymous sources. And that was also another lesson. And I just felt that I don't want to use, you know, anonymous sources ever again. And it's really interesting because it was years later, I started continuing doing the work I was doing on Guantanamo. And but it was years later, a couple of years later, 3 years later, and I remember it because it was through a friend, somebody had passed me some documents. And these were documents that this person received under the Freedom of Information Act. These were extraordinary documents. They were a PowerPoint presentation. It was a PowerPoint presentation given to nuclear missile officers. These are the people who are in charge of literally turning the key if they're, you have to launch nuclear weapons. What these documents showed, this PowerPoint, this was about the ethics and morals of launching nuclear weapons. In this presentation that showed that Jesus Christ, literally, would support launching nuclear weapons. And they had pictures of Jesus on a horse and they also, you know,
I want you to send that afterward.
It's called, the headline of the story is Jesus Loves Nukes. And then they had something on Wernher von Braun, who was the father of modern-day space program, but also a former SS Nazi, as the sort of holding him up as the person for, you know, being moral and ethical. So I put the story out. I published the story, and I attached these documents, and it was remarkable to see the response because the story went viral. And this had been an ethics program that had been in place for 20 years. After the story came out, and literally this was all over the place, the Air Force, they ended this program. They ended this training. So talk about impact, right? They immediately ended it. And it was at that moment where I was like, I need to do more of this. I need to do more of this type of work where the documents become the primary source material. One, it allowed me to continue doing the work. Two, it could be a good path for me to, you know, help restore my credibility. Because this was a really bad mistake. And then, you know, looking back, I mean, at the time, it was terrible. Because journalism is really something I cared about, and I made, you know, a terrible mistake in writing that story. But it was, you know, also an opportunity to become a better journalist. And really, that terrible mistake allowed me to become a better journalist. The one that I am today, which I'm, you know, very proud of the journalist that, you know, that I am. But I worked very hard. So that was that opportunity. That was that moment. And it was FOIA. And I had this friend of mine. I said, where did you get this? He said, oh, I filed FOIA requests. I'm like, teach me everything you know. And that was the, you know, that was the path. That's the emotional part of our talk this evening, folks. So
now we're going to hug.
Yeah, now we're going to hug. We're all going to hug.
Right.
But, you know, yes, that's part of my story. You know, you have, as journalists, you have ups and downs. I've been doing this for almost 20 years. Karl Rove ended up writing about me in his book. And he called me a nut with internet access. And I can look back on that now and kind of laugh about it. But at the time, I was not laughing.
So thank you guys very much for coming out. I think we're going to wrap it up.
Yeah, this was great.
Yeah, this was really great.
Thank you.